Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
So you are what you eat, and lately some of us are getting sick from what we are eating. Have you served spinach on your dinner table since the outbreak of E. coli in that vegetable in September? Did you gradually, grudgingly, timidly go back to it? Are you scared of visiting any fast food joint? Not due to the trans fats, but due to the scallions now? Is all of this making you feel like you need to overboil all your food? Yuck. Do you feel like starting a vegetable patch on your fire escape because you can't trust the foods from the markets? Even from the farms to the markets to the restaurants anymore? Well, join me to talk about these food scares and our changing perception towards certain foods and whether the spinach and scallions things are complete coincidences is Nina Plank, the former director of New York's Green Market and author of Real Food, What to Eat and Why, published by Bloomsbury. Nina, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So do you see the scallions and the spinach situations as related or unrelated?
Well, they're related in one sense, certainly, and I am not a food safety detective. There will be people tracing, you know, the origins and pathways of these outbreaks, serious food safety officials. But they're related in this way, which is that I think the ultimate source of E. coli is in large part, not 100%, traceable to factory farms and the abominable way in which we feed beef and dairy cattle. And not, in fact, a vegetable farm. So in some ways, the scallion, the spinach growers and the scallion distributors and the Taco Bell cooks are innocent victims of a much bigger industrial food problem.
Now, you've got a lot of listeners scratching their heads already because they're going to say, wait a minute, what is what we feed cattle, whether it's good or bad, have to do with how the scallions turn out?
Very good question. So long ago in the galaxy far away, beef and dairy cattle ate 100% grass and other roughage, other forage, it's called. So they are herbivores. They eat grass. And sometime in about the 50s in this country, they started to find that they could increase milk production and fatten beef cattle faster by feeding them grain, soybean, corn, and lately also antibiotics and steroids. And on this diet, sure enough, they produce a lot of milk and they don't have to go outside and they fatten quickly and they can be contained on feedlots. But it's not good for cattle digestive systems. Basically, it gives them a very acid stomach, which gives them health problems. Something called acidosis is the severe version of it and will actually kill animals if they don't have enough fiber. Mm-hmm. And it also has meant that a new strain of E. coli, which is able to survive in an acid environment, has literally been created by these grain diets. And
so,
why does this matter? Well, it matters because the old form of E. coli, and there are lots of E. coli's, it's pretty much harmless. It lives in cattle guts, and it lives in our guts, and it doesn't do anything bad to us. But this new one, E. coli 0157, survives in these highly acid cattle guts and then survives in our guts. So normally when you ingest the old kind of E. coli, your stomach acid is strong enough to kill it, not this one.
But I'm still trying to trace it. Does it come out in the cattle's waste and then somehow contaminates the vegetable fields?
There are a number of paths. One is probably the large manure lagoons that go along with these confined animal feeding operations, which are called CAFOs, So those manure lagoons, and we have a lot of them in upstate New York, sadly, do contaminate groundwater, drinking water, irrigation water. They can anyway. So that's one possible path. Another study I've seen suggests that flies from cattle manure lagoons are transporting E. coli. Wild pigs has been suggested, and of course there is human contamination. That is, somehow this E. coli is on the hands of farm workers or restaurant workers.
And thank you all for joining us as you're making your lunch. Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, had an op-ed in Today's Times, maybe you saw it, and part of his thesis is that the problem stems from industrialization and centralization of the American food production system. Is food more dangerous if the kind of thing that you've been talking about is really one of the causes? Is it then more likely to spread due to our ability to have it travel greater distances and from one centralized source?
It's a really good point. One of the reasons local food and a lot of small producers is safer is that contamination doesn't reach these kind of bottlenecks. Now, a bottleneck is bad in this sense. If we have a lot of food passing through one small part of the food chain. For example, in a beef slaughterhouse, many, many animals are slaughtered at a very rapid pace on one conveyor belt. So if there happens to be E. coli in one in, I have no idea how many animals, 1,000, 10,000, one in 100, it is likely to splatter over other things. So cross-contamination at sort of choke points in the industrial food chain is definitely a problem. And on the whole, I trust the traditional food chain more than the industrial food chain.
My guest on WNYC is Nina Plank, the former director of New York's Green Market and author of the book Real Food, What to Eat and Why, published by Bloomsbury. As we're looking for the links between the spinach-based E. coli outbreak and the scallions-based E. coli outbreak and the larger implications for food safety in America and food policy in America. And we can take your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. And let's take a call now. Tim in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm wondering if this is possibly an emerging public health emergency growing out of the use of human antibiotics on a massive scale in our livestock. And I wonder if any research has been done as to whether these new strains have developed resistance to antibiotics from that exposure in the livestock.
That's definitely a problem. There is good research on it. That's why the European Union has banned the use of antibiotics for preventive use in animal production, banned the use of human antibiotics for preventive use in animal production, which basically means if it's an antibiotic your doctor might want to use on you, they cannot use it just in order to fatten cattle faster or to keep chickens from getting sick in the confinement conditions they live in. And several large chicken producers here have voluntarily recently stopped using a couple of antibiotics on chickens. It's a very, very serious problem. I'm not aware that there is a specific link to antibiotic resistance and this form, this particularly virulent form of E. coli, 0157.
All right, Tim, thanks a lot. In the past, decade maybe, there's been more of a push to eat local produce. But do you think that consumers of local produce are isolated to elite pockets of the population?
Not at all. In fact, I was on a book tour this summer for Real Food and went all over the country, and it is remarkable how many people buy local food because it tastes better and not because they're a member of some kind of bi-coastal blue state elite. We've been selling heirloom and good-tasting hybrid garden tomatoes to people in Loudoun County, Virginia, ever since I was a little girl, and those are not people who got the idea from Chez Panisse.
Jason in Astoria might beg to differ a little bit. Hi, Jason.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
All right. How
are
you doing?
Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I do beg to differ a little. I mean, I really support, you know, the local food, know where it's grown, you know, movement. I mean, I love shopping at the farmer's market. I live in New York City and whatnot. But when I travel to, like, the Midwest where I'm from, like St. Louis and whatnot, I mean, they have Whole Foods and everything. But I still think that, you know, a lot of the default answer on these, like when you read Michael Pollan or Eric Schlosser, who I said, like, I support, you get this sense that, you know, you need to know who your farmer is and you need to know all this stuff, and that's just really not possible for a lot of people in the country. And I think that, you know, that kind of extreme version of the debate has detracted. I mean, there was a story in the Times, I think, this weekend or late last week about this whole green onion thing, and, you know, the FDA is out there saying, like, we just don't have the money or the resources to enforce, you know, new regulations on, you know, food lots or and farmers and whatnot. And so I just think that, I mean, I think that, you know, we need to remember that industrial food came about for a reason and provides people with, you know, a lot of the staples of the food they need. And, you know, a lot of us can no longer go get our milk from, you know, a local dairy producer or whatnot.
I think you make a really good point, Jason, and it's important for us to expand and develop the market for real food, for local food, slow food, real food. And that means, I think, in some interesting cases, more middlemen. For example, I grew up in farmers markets, have worked in farmers markets all my life. I run them in Washington and London, and now have a new market in New York City, which just finished its season. But I don't think that expansion of farmers markets is the only answer. We need more distributors, middlemen, retailers, supermarkets, schools, jails, hospitals, all kinds of people involved in buying more local or regional or non-industrial food. And that means that most of us won't be meeting our farmer on a daily basis. I don't meet farmers every day of the week, even though I'm lucky to live in New York City where I have access to a green market 6 days out of seven. And then the question of cost is a really important one. It is true that industrial food is artificially cheap, and one reason it was cheap to fatten cattle on grain is that nitrogen fertilizer and pesticides and corn, all of these things are readily available and cheap, partly because of corn subsidies, partly because of oil policy. But ultimately, it would be a hell of a lot cheaper to raise cattle on grass. We have in upstate New York an abundance of grass. We do not have an abundance of corn or oil. We have plenty of grass and water. And by Cornell's own estimates, we will lose 6,000 family dairy farms in the next 15 years in New York State.
But now, even if it's cheaper to raise beef cattle on grass, and agribusiness may beg to differ with that estimate, but even if it is, they have a taste thing, right? I mean, I've seen, you know, I've heard commercials for steakhouses that advertise the fact that the cows that produce their beef are corn-fed and that there's a relationship between that and the tenderness and tastiness of the meat. So if they're finding, you know, a taste reason to feed beef cattle, especially corn, then they're probably going to keep doing it.
Very good point. And in the 1950s, when we started to get corn-fed beef was absolutely marketed as the premium product. There is a difference in flavor. But that doesn't mean that's the way beef has to taste. Grass-fed beef is a little bit sweeter to some people. And there are people who raise beef predominantly on grass and then finish them on a little grain. There are purists who won't do that at all. I happen to think if you want some grain-finished beef, it's not a terrible thing. That's not it's not so hard on the animal. If you carry on feeding them grain, they literally die. So you can only feed them grain briefly. The same goes for some dairy farmers who are almost 100% grass farmers but supplement with a little grain to keep their animals in good condition, especially in the winter when hay isn't enough. I think there's a lot of room in this market for diversity, mm-hmm. for choice, for flavor, for preference, for different prices. And mostly I just like people to know what all their choices are.
Let's go to another call. Pam and Edison, you're on WNYC. Hi, Pam.
Hi. My question for your guest is, if this is true about what you've been saying, how come we haven't had mass epidemics of E. coli all over the place? We've had these limited cases of spinach and scallions that have hurt a few people, but we haven't had the kind of mass epidemics that would have happened.
Well, it's an interesting point, Pam, and for all the media brouhaha about these two E. coli outbreaks from the spinach and now from the scallions, they're in the news largely because they're rare events, Nina Plank.
I don't know the answer. The caller has a very good question. I assume it's because the ordinary protections of the food chain largely work day to day. That water is mostly purified, or that the employees in Taco Bell and in slaughterhouses mostly wash their hands. Until the detectives can trace the exact path of these outbreaks, we don't know how they come about. I do know that the way we regulate food and farming in this country and the way we protect public health leaves a lot to be desired. One of our main problems starts in Washington is the fact that the USDA has responsibility for promoting American agricultural products, which is totally appropriate, and I promote them too, but also for regulating them and protecting public health. And I think it would make a lot more sense if we did what the Brits did after the mad cow epidemic there. And I was living in England at the time and then running farmers markets there, as I still am. And they divided those responsibilities. Basically, they decided they would have a ministry for agriculture that would promote agriculture, and they would have an agency for food safety, which would protect.
Well, we have an agriculture department and the FDA. Is it different?
They are not really comparable in that USDA has responsibility for meat and poultry, that is regulation and food safety. FDA has responsibility for the food safety with vegetables. It's not a logical regulatory structure, just even dividing between USDA and FDA.
Right.
But more to the point, it has an inherent conflict in it, which is that it's really tough to take the beef industry and say, you know, antibiotics are a problem, or steroids.
Because same branch of government that's trying to promote the beef industry and its success is regulating its safety.
That's right.
All right. Well, we'll close with an email that just came in from a man named Berger, believe it or not, that says, how can this relate to terrorism? Is this contamination possibly a terrorist act? Does this give terrorists a new opening? The manure lagoons are now breeding ground for bioterror weapons?
My guess is that if the terrorists wanted to find a choke point in the industrial food chain and do something bad to it, they'd have a lot more luck doing that than they would causing trouble at the 3,700 farmers markets all over the country. So I'd say buy local.
Nina Plank, author of the book Real Food, What to Eat and Why, published by Bloomsbury. Thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.